You're listening to Louisiana Insider, a superlative guide to a great state's destinations, hosted by Errol Labor, executive editor of Louisiana Life magazine.
It's our Louisiana song. It's our favorite melody. It's our Louisiana song. Hearing it echo through the cypress tree.
Our topic is history today, particularly one area of Louisiana history that's fascinating. A lot of stories to tell, a lot of heartbreak, a lot of hard times, but a lot of fulfillment too along the way. And this is the Civil Rights Trail in Louisiana. The state has a really, really good program. It developed from something that developed from federal funding, a federal program to try to encourage across the country more interest in sideways and roadways. And the state has a program called the Louisiana Scenic Byways, and it started with federal funding. And over time, they've developed something like, I think now they have like 18 trails or 19 trails. And you can find them if you go to that website, go to this Louisiana Travel website, and they're really good trails. And they designate places around the state. I'll talk a little bit about some of those trails later. And they have these markers, and then you can get information about things that are along the trails. And it's really, for example, there's the Toledo Bend Forest Scenic Byway, the Tunica Trace Byway, sort of apropos for today's conversation, is something called the Northrop Trail, which is tied in with the 12 years of slave story. And so you can find that, you can go like the key places along the way. So anyway, what we're gonna be talking about is some of the stops along the Civil Rights Trail and some of the stories that are part of it. With me is Linda McKinley. She has her own company, GMC Incorporated, and she's been working on this project for a long time, and so knows it intimately. And so thank you very much for joining us, Linda.
Good to be here.
Okay. And then those of you, especially New Orleans, are going to say, whoa, it's good to hear him again. Norman Robinson. Okay.
Hi, Harold.
Longtime news anchor for he was the Channel 6. He had a stint with NBC, didn't you? Up the big
well, league. Actually, it was a stint with CBS. It was Allie Gifford, my mentor, who had the stint with NBC. We interestingly enough, we followed the same career path. He went to NBC. He could only stand him for a year. Mm-hmm. I went to CBS, and I could only stand them for a year. We came back to New Orleans.
And then the one other little side note about your career was when you were in the military, you were in the Marines, but not just a normal Marine, you were in the Marine Band in Washington, in the White House Band.
And you played, that's right. That's right, I played euphonium. Euphonium, and for all of you who are not familiar with the term euphonium, it's a baritone horn, but us professionals, once we get to be professionals, we graduate from the baritone horn to the euphonium. So we get to play the big boy's horn.
Yeah, in your case, playing the White House band, that's pretty cool. You
know? Well, I was actually in the Marine Corps field band. You know, the White House band is for those guys who were like really, really good. I was good, but not really, really good. So I got to play in the field bands, which meant we traveled all across the country. And I was in bands. I was in the field band in Paris Island. I was in the field band in Norfolk, Virginia, where I went to military, where I went to music school at the Naval U.S. Naval School of Music in Norfolk, Virginia. And then I was transferred to Southern California, Oceanside, California, which is about 45 miles north and southwest of Los Angeles. And then my last duty station was in Santa Ana, California, which was at the El Toro 3rd Marine Air Wing field, which no longer exists now. I guess they decided since I quit and mustered out, they decided to close the base down.
That's their motto. If Norman can't be here, why do it?
That's what I'm talking about.
Probably among euphonium players, you were one of the best, so.
Oh yeah, I must say that I knew my way around the music scales. I could handle my end of the lower brass section.
Okay. And Linda, you have a a music heritage too, which I want to talk a little bit about a little bit later. Your dad was Larry McKinley, who was a well-known disc jockey, and he was one of the founders of the Jazz Fest, and he was with the co-owner of Minute Records. He's involved with
Minute Records. Right.
And some songs, some really prominent songs came out of Minute Records, and we're gonna play a few seconds of one a little bit later. And so, but let's get down to the business of at hand, talking about this Civil Rights Trail. Glenda, as we understand, there's about four places. Tell me what the future of the trail is now. How many places are there going to be?
There's going to be, right now we anticipate there'll be a total of 15 markers. The trail is really kind of a digital platform that lives online. It really tells the story of Louisiana's courageous role in the modern civil rights movement. It's a story that a lot of people are not familiar with. And so as a result of the trail and going to, I think we traveled to 22 locations around the state, over 3,000 miles, and we talked to all these different communities to really allow them to tell the stories of the civil rights activities in their areas. As a result of that, we developed the Louisiana Civil Rights Trail, which is a tourism product, but you can mostly experience and hear these stories and all of these courageous heroes and their acts and you know, what they're fighting, what's all about on LouisianaCivilRightsTrail.com. But as a result of that, we realized very quickly, and you know, this is really a vision of Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser, and Norma can tell you a little bit about the genesis of that and how, I mean, he got actually called to the project before I did. You know, as a result of that, as we were hearing all these stories, the opportunity came up for us to be able to commemorate some of these sites, locations, and activities with what we call the hero markers. And so right now we've already installed four, one in Baton Rouge at the state capitol commemorating the bus boycott in New Orleans at Dookie Chase's restaurant, which was a very big organizing location. One at the most recent one was AZ Young Park commemorating the Bugaloosa to Baton Rouge March, and in Shreveport at Little Union Baptist Church. So I think there will be a total of 15. But you know, it is very much a fluid project and a work in progress.
Okay. I want to talk about those spots. But Norman, since your name was mentioned, you were involved in this project from the earlier days, or?
Yeah, Errol. It's interesting how I got involved. I was minding my own business.
Oh, there you go.
As a member of the New Orleans Rotary Club, I was chairman of the speakers committee. My duty to find a venue for the celebration or reception for the Rotary delegation from Orléans, France, and so since I know Ben and I consider him a good friend of mine, I called him and asked him if he could help me. He said that not only will I help you, I will reserve the venue myself, and I will bring down some tourism material for the French delegation. So he reserved a room at the Oyster restaurant, which is at what do you call it? It's in Harrah's, and then there's one in Metairie. If my brain's playing tricks on me right now, but it's,
I think it's Drago's. Is it Drago's?
Yeah, Drago's. Yeah. So we were at Drago's, and as I was talking to the lieutenant governor during the event, he said that, you know, he says, "What are you doing now?" I says, I do a little consulting, and I'm on a lot of boards for charity groups." And he said, are you involved in communication at all? And I said, I'm a talker. That's what I do. I get paid for talking. And he said, well, I'm interested in starting a group to form a Louisiana civil rights historic trail. And he says, the reason I'm interested is because I was at a lieutenant governor's conference in Phoenix, Arizona. I think that was 2018, 2019. And he said, I was embarrassed when they brought up the subject of historic civil rights trails. And he said, all these governors, all these lieutenant governors and all these people who were connected with their tourism departments were talking about, you know, the wonderful historic civil rights trails that had been, you know, accepted and ordained into the United States civil rights trail. And he said, we didn't have anything to show. And I was quite embarrassed. And he said, I made up my mind that we were going to do something in Louisiana because we had a historic, we had some fabulous stories to tell. And he said, would you mind becoming involved? And I said, yeah. And my role, of course, Glenda and her group, they were handling the organization and the creative end of it. My role was just to moderate all the town hall meetings that we had all over the state. And she mentioned that we had about 22 town hall meetings, and we traveled about 3,000 miles across the state, you know, from New Orleans all the way to Shreveport, and from Bastrop all the way to Bogalusa. And what we were interested in doing was hearing the stories from the people who were at the grassroots level, but, you know, not the people who had been the high profile leaders, but the people who were among the masses, the people who were out there being beaten, the people who were out there being harassed, the people who were out there being intimidated, the people who were out there being threatened with harm, and the people who were being harassed with intimidating phone calls. And we got to meet those people. We got to find out what they were doing. We got to find out, you know, how they were living. We got to find out what they thought about their journey. And we got to find out, you know, how it had affected them. And in fact, some of the adults were still traumatized by their experience, because the adults were then children. They were then younger people. And it was a cathartic experience for a lot of them, where they got to vent and they for the first time got to really share what was on their mind for some 50 years, you know, and it was kind of moving for a lot of us. You know, I didn't shed any tears because I'm not a crier, but I tell you what, I came very close.
It was very interesting because, you know, I feel like people were able to share these stories and they had these memories as if it happened yesterday. And wherever we went, we were often met with a lot of skepticism. Why are you guys doing this? What is this all about? Is it politically motivated? And it was none of that. Actually, the intentions were great. People were, you know, they weren't sure whether or not we were going to pull it off. But the intentions from the very beginning was to demonstrate that Louisiana played a very significant role in the modern civil rights movement. In fact, when you look at the history, you know, even like, for instance, the bus boycott, the famous Montgomery bus boycott was modeled after the Baton Rouge bus boycott. And it was so interesting because people were sharing these stories and this pain as if it happened yesterday. You know, it was just so very fresh, and they were just so happy to have been asked to tell their stories. And we knew every time we went into a different location, like, well, what is the civil rights trail? What is it going to be? What's it going to look like? And we told them that we didn't know, that they were, that was exactly the reason why we were having the meetings, because it was their input that would help us to inform what the trail looked like. And so we knew very early on that there was no reason for us to try to tell this story when the people who were involved in the movement, who were on the front lines of the movement, were still alive, many of them, and could tell exactly, could tell in much more detail and much more authenticity, you know, what the experience was like. And, you know, as a result of that, like I said, we developed the Louisiana Civil Rights Trail, and it has all of these rich, rich stories about the role that the state played in the movement.
By the way, if you'll, I urge all listeners to look at the website for this. It's a beautiful website. They've done a really good job with it. Well, let's talk about some of the site markers. The most recent, the Baton Rouge at the A.Z. Young Park, which commemorates the Bugaloo, the Baton Rouge March. Whenever you want to talk about that incident or story?
Well, let me start it, if you don't mind.
Oh, yes.
I'm particularly excited about that marker. It's very special to me because A.Z. Young was one of my heroes. He was an articulate man. He was larger than life, and he was a World War II veteran. He was a tank commander in the U.S. Army in World War II, and he had participated in 133. It might have been 123 or 133 battles in the European theater, and he was very proud of that. And he said he fought for his country to gain the rights of people who were being oppressed all over the world. And he came back to the United States and found out that he was still oppressed. And he fought for the rights of other people, fought for to give them rights that he didn't even have in his own country. And he wasn't going to have any of that. He was tired of it. He was in Bogalusa working at Crown Zellerbach. And he became president of their union because he was the only one who was not afraid to speak out. He said that he faced the death. He had faced death and many times, 133 times, and he was not about to yield to the threats and intimidation from people who didn't respect him and from people he didn't respect. So he started. He became a vocal voice in the Bogalusa community, and he started to speak out. And he joined the. He became president of the Voters League. And at the time that they were trying to get some kind of face-to-face meeting with Governor John McKiffin over the oppression of African Americans, and he wrote McKiffin, and McKiffin didn't return his letters. He called McKiffin, and McKiffin refused to take his calls. And he said that he was not going to be denied. So he decided that he and the other civil rights activists would form a march from Bogalusa to Baton Rouge to confront the governor on the state capitol, because he felt as chief executive officer of the state of Louisiana that the governor was obligated to all citizens, not just the white citizens, but the black citizens as well. And he wanted the black citizens' grievances to be redressed by the chief executive officer who was responsible and obligated to all of the welfare and health of all of its citizens. So that was the genesis of the march. And as you know, it took 10 days. 105 miles in the heat of the summer, and they were met by Klansmen in Satsuma, Louisiana, where they engaged in hand-to-hand combat with the Klansmen and others who were trying to stop the march. and AZ at one point said the Louisiana State Police walked up to him and said, you know, maybe it's a good idea to just put your people in buses and cars, and we'll just escort you to the state capitol via motorized convoy. And AZ said, no, we're not going to do that. That would defeat the whole point. That would make us look like we were giving in. And he said, no, we're willing to do what we set out to do. And that was march. We're going to make this trip on foot. And they managed to get by the Klansmen in Satsuma because one of the Klansmen, I guess by either intention or mistake, managed to hit a state trooper. And when he hit the state trooper, the state troopers then went to work on the Klansmen, and there was blood on the highway. And so they continued the march without any more hand-to-hand combat, although they were harassed along the way in Denham Springs. But they finally got to Baton Rouge, where they held that famous rally on the steps of the state capitol, with A.Z. Young making his pitch for equal justice and equal rights. Making rights real is what Linda calls it. And that's a wonderful caption, where people like AZ, because of their courage and their fearlessness, were able to make rights real, since they were not going to be denied. They were no longer going to be subjugated by the people who were oppressing them. So that's why that particular marker, that particular site means so much to me.
Okay. Here's
and it was actually unveiled. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
It was unveiled actually the day before, was it? What anniversary was it? I can't recall, Norman. Do you remember?
I think it was the 50th anniversary. I think it was the 50th anniversary. It was, we unveiled that marker the day before the 50th anniversary, which was another highlight of that particular ceremony.
Well, here's my recollection, at least what I've heard about that, which doesn't differ too much from what you said, but with one caveat, and tell me if I'm wrong, okay. McKithen, as was common at that time, was elected pretty much, he's from North Louisiana, and his platform was fairly much of a racist platform. He ran against Shep Morrison, who was the mayor of New Orleans, who already had a black vote, and so it wasn't a question of trying to appeal to him. And so during the campaign, McKithen really wasn't what you call on the right side. But as governor, he changed. And what I recall about that is, was it the night before that march, McKithen making a speech, and I'm paraphrasing, okay, but saying things like, you know, everybody has a right to protest. These people have a right to march. We're going to protect them. If anybody causes them any trouble, you know, they could be in trouble with the state. And really made a strong statement, surprising statement, backing the march. And from that point on, the rest of his administration, because it was at a point where a lot of civil rights issues were starting to bubble, that McKithen kind of had changed and was on a different side. Do you recall any of that? What I
recall, Errol, is him being forced after the federal government put pressure on him and the National Guard was sent. I recall him being forced to protect the rights of the marchers. That's what I recall. And I recall him also finally relenting to the pressure that was being put on him by A.V. Young and that tremendous number of people who showed up, because they tried to stop the march in the beginning. And they weren't successful to stop it. And once the march was put in place, and all of the plans were made so that the march would take place, and it appeared that it was going to go forth. And he didn't want that kind of negative stain that had been visited upon the civil rights people in Mississippi and Alabama. He didn't want that in Louisiana. So yeah, he did change his tune. But remember, the march took place because of his obstinance, because he refused to meet with the civil rights activists, and because he refused to do anything about the police beatings of the African Americans, and he refused to do anything about school integration, and he refused to do anything about or take a position on the killing of and wounding of two of the first African American sheriff's deputies that had been hired to office in Washington Parish. You'll recall that one of the deputies was shot to death, and the other one was blinded by a shotgun blast. So all of these things kind of bubbled over. They roiled over, and they upset the African American community, and they poured gasoline on the flames, and ignited something that was going to be bigger than McKithen wanted to deal with. So that's my recollection.
Okay, well, I think that was the time, though, when Southern governors, if not McKithen, were starting to change, that you're going to start seeing, you weren't going to see the old-time racist Southern governors anymore. And you started seeing it, you know.
Well, that's the reason they did change, Errol. They did change.
Yeah.
But they were sort of helped to change.
If I may, I can tell you that is really one of the values. What it is kind of like the beauty of the Louisiana Civil Rights Trail.com is that you can actually go there and kind of navigate through the site. And if you are looking for information related to that event, not only are there is an overview of the story, there are also oral histories. You can look at news articles. And so I think people can just do a deeper dive and explore each of the stories related to Louisiana's role in the civil rights movement.
I remember hearing a story, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but at one point when McKinton was governor, he took a tour of Southern University, and and with him was the student body president, and the student body president was young Bill Jefferson. And Jefferson was showing up personally, and it was a very polite, visit. But McKinton says something, and again, I'm paraphrasing, says, you know, everything is fine. I just hope that there's no demonstrations here or anything, because otherwise we're going to have to bring in, the forces of the state. And Jefferson says, he's a senior in college, okay? He says, Governor, you've got your constituents and I have mine. Anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
I will say one thing about everything that I've heard about A.Z. Young is that, you know, I heard he was just absolutely fearless. Like, he just absolutely had no fear of anything. And he was just determined to make rights real. And you know, once you've made that decision and you're not afraid of death or the worst possible outcome, then you just keep moving forward. And, you know, he was a very charismatic leader in that way.
If you think at that time, who were the leaders, at least the best known leaders in the Black community have been? There weren't any Black elected officials at the time. And so it would have been people from Black organizations like that. And I guess ministers, what would provide the leadership?
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, well, I will tell you, this is the interesting thing. And this was a strategic decision on our point. When you think about the civil rights movement, you know, people like to think about, it was a very brutal time, right? And people, you see all these images of the fire hydrants and the dogs and all the brutality, and there was plenty of that. But we really wanted to focus on the heroes of the movement. I mean, they were very proud, progressive people. My father, I think about listening to them and watching them as they were telling these stories, as they were planning, as they were organizing. And I think we really wanted to demonstrate the power and the pride and the courage behind the people, other people who were behind the movement. And I think when you look at the markers, as we were thinking about them, and actually my son is the associate creative director at the agency, he was doing a lot of research on the project. And more we researched it and we were showing different prototypes and designs for the markers, it became very, very clear that it had to be an image of the people. You had to come face to face with the people, because that was the way you could really demonstrate exactly what they were doing and how they were doing it. So we really wanted people to come face to face with the people who were on the front lines.
Yeah, and Glenda, it was, we shouldn't forget that it was an integrated movement. The civil rights movement was an integrated movement. In fact, we learned a lot of things that people didn't know. When we got to Grambling, we learned that students from LSU, from Louisiana State University, came down and volunteered to help the civil rights community rebuild churches that had been burned down by Klansmen. So those kinds of stories lend itself to the universal humanity of people who wanted to do the right thing. And you know, it was those kind of stories that we wouldn't have known about had we not done what we did with the town hall meetings, which those meetings were, I think, the lieutenant governor's. That's what he wanted. He wanted to touch people at the very bottom level of the movement, you know. So, you know, stories like that lend itself to what happened and took place to make rights real.
Yeah, I think there a lot of stories, like, white students providing support. But on the other hand, there was the tragedies like what happened in Mississippi with the for civil rights workers,
you know, yeah,
kidnapped and killed. In their case, they were kidnapped and killed by white people. I mean, by Klan's members. And so, but there was a lot of good stories involved in it. Also, let's talk about the the buses, about the segregation of the buses. Now, there's a marker in Baton Rouge, and where's that marker located?
It's at the old state capitol.
Okay.
Which is where the nation's first bus boycott was held in Baton Rouge. And it really was just a very historic and courageous move by Black residents seeking fair treatment. They comprised 80% of the city's bus ridership, but were all forced to stand at the back of the bus. And at some point, they just absolutely said, we've had enough, and we would basically just stop riding the bus. As you know, that will shut down a bus system if you have the majority, 80% of your ridership, that's no longer riding the bus. And so, again, to Norman's point, white people, Black people, community organizers got together, and they just had a bus boycott, and they were getting people to where they needed to go. It really shows how reliant we are on one another, because if I don't go to work, then, you know, so many things shut down. It's just basically a domino effect. And so they really demonstrated that in numbers, they had the power. I don't think that ultimately ended the way they wanted it to when it started, but, you know, it really did become a model for the Montgomery bus boycott that happened years later.
Now, New Orleans had the same system too. I'm not sure about which came first and which ended first, but New Orleans for many years had that sign that on the back seats, and you could push it back, and in effect it said that, well, it uses colored people as the word, that they had to sit behind that sign.
Yeah,
so, that happened. I'm not sure if the change came first in New Orleans or...
That happened all over the South, Errol, because I can remember as a little boy in Mobile, Alabama, getting on the bus, and I had to get you could only access the bus from the rear door, and you had to sit behind this sign. Even when I was a little boy in Tombsuba, Mississippi, we used to have to catch the Greyhound bus to town. And we had, we stood up at this pole that said bus stop, you know, and we'd get wet in the rain, you know, we'd be cold in the winter, hot in the summer, and the bus would stop, but we'd have to go all the way to the back. And I remember many trips sitting by that back bathroom, which was not a real comfortable place to be. No, but this was that was the way it was over the entire South. You know, you had the colored here and whites here, and the colored only water fountain, the white only water fountain, and then you went to the restaurant. You had the back door, your colored entrance. You had the white entrance. So this was the thing that happened after Plessy versus Ferguson. You know, the Jim Crow thing that was the Jim Crow laws that were instituted. So it was not just New Orleans and Baton Rouge. That was the way it was. That was the law over the in entire South, separate but equal.
I guess after 1964 with the Civil Rights Bill that started to loosen those things a little bit. But more importantly, 1967, the Voting Rights Act, because all of a sudden there were a lot more Black people on voting rolls. And so they became more of a political force. And that was probably something that governors were seeing too, you know, that they were looking at the voting rolls. And it was one thing when the Black vote was a bunch of people who went to like a Third and Baptist church, but when all of a sudden people, were registering large numbers, that had to have a big impact.
Yeah, that's when they started tinkering with the voting rights laws. That's when they started tinkering with you had the test, you had to guess how many beans were in a particular jar, you know, how many marbles, and you had to name the preamble to the Constitution, you know, and then they had to name all the presidents. So, you know, there were subtle and not so subtle ways of trying to oppress or stymie the Black vote, even after the Voting Rights Act was passed.
Well, as an aside, if I had to name all the presidents today, there were a few I'd like to take off the list. That's another story.
You know what, Norman, as we talk about Baton Rouge and the bus boycott, you might want to share a little bit about your interview with
Johnny Jones.
Yes.
Oh, wow. You know, there were, you know, the bus boycott, I think, was also a scientific academic experiment for what was to come with the with the Brown versus the Board of Education Act, where Johnny Jones was one of the activists who was, he was a lawyer, and he was involved in the bus boycott, and he went on to form or write some of the motions and that would be filed in court before the United States Supreme Court justices to argue for the rights equal rights under the law pertaining to the Constitution of the United States. And I remember interviewing this man at, I think he was 100. Was he 101 when I interviewed him, Linda?
I think he just turned 100. I'm not
he
sure.
He turned 100. And he took me to school. You know, he says I wrote the motions that were argued before the United States Supreme Court. You understand? So the activists in Baton Rouge were academics, they were lawyers, you know, they were housewives, they were maids, they were janitors, you know, they were construction workers, you know, they were cab drivers, and people like Johnny Jones helped to formulate what would end up being, you know, the planks for the foundation that built up to the cases where the Jim Crow laws were struck down finally.
And the in Shreveport, what is the church that you all have, the Ebenezer?
Little Union Baptist Church.
Okay.
And they were, you know, a lot of people aren't aware of the role that Shreveport played, but you know, the Little Union Baptist Church and I think Galilee Baptist Church, and Little Union's pastor was Claude Clifford McLean. And that church, from what I understand, was basically the epicenter of civil rights activities in Shreveport. If there was a bus boycott, if there was just any kind of voter registration or anything, it happened there. And so we were very, very excited to be able to include them. We wanted to make sure that the trail was balanced, that people in locations and sites from all over the state were included. Little Union Baptist Church was also the scene where there was an attack on the worshipers during the 1963 memorial service for the victims of the Birmingham church bombing. And it was a pretty brutal attack. But, you know, I think there was just a lot of fearlessness and a lot of people who were just very determined. Again, these laws were on the books. They were all fighting to make rights real. And that's what we just have to remember. That was just such an important part of what they were doing.
Yeah, that was the epicenter of the civil rights movement in Shreveport, was the Little Union Baptist Church. That confrontation between, well, it wasn't actually a confrontation because the police went in there and just beat the hell out of everybody. In fact, they beat the president of the NAACP within inches of his life. And in fact, because it was such a big rally, they were going to, that's where they were plotting the strategy for the movement, where it would go, you know, and who it would represent and where they would march. And what they would say during the marches, and the police got wind of it, and they rode horses into the church. They went into the church on horseback, beating people and dragging people out, and they were looking for the leaders of the civil rights movement, and some of the leaders had to be smuggled out of the church. And I remember the story about one of the leaders was smuggled out in a hearse. That's how he got out of Freeport with his life intact. They took him out in a hearse, and they were able to get him past the police because, you know, the police didn't inspect the hearse. So when they beat everybody up and ran him out of the church, you know, with the horses and you know, to this day, that's a blight on the Freeport Police Department, and they don't like to talk about that. But
it was also the last location I think Martin Luther King Jr. spoke at in the state of Louisiana. There is a room at Little Union Baptist Church, and you can visit it. And it has the podium and the Bible and everything where he spoke. So it's a very interesting attraction. A lot of people don't know about it. Again, you can read more about all of these things and hear these stories on LouisianaCivilRightsTrail.com. And I will also, encourage people to take a look at the videos and hear in their own voices people talking about what happened, and look at all the archives. So much research went into getting the accurate information and letting, and really this being a portal for the information, because, you know, we're not trying to tell the story, but I think we are trying to pass the story on, or we're not trying to interpret the story. We're trying to pass it on to future generations so that they can understand exactly, you know, whose shoulders they're standing on.
Mm-hmm. You know, my impression is that in North Louisiana was more rigid on matters of integration than the South Louisiana would have been. I just think it was a harder area on those kind of issues. I don't know, maybe had a little bit more of the Cajun culture in South Louisiana was more tolerant, but North Louisiana was pretty rough.
Yeah, that's where you had most of your Klan's people were located in those areas. And in South Louisiana, it was the Cajun and Creole culture that was more genteel, if I could use that word in reference to people who were discriminating against other people. But they were more genteel in how they dealt with different ethnic groups. And, you know, I even hate using the word racial because we're all members of the human race. We have different cultures and different ethnicities, but, you know, we're all one race, and that's the human race. But as is the case right now, you find more stratification in places north of Interstate 10 than you do in places that are south of Interstate 10, and that's just cultural. You know, that's just cultural.
Let's move on to South Louisiana real quickly. The first of these markers to go up was at Dougie Chase. So the Dougie Chase, a restaurant. Okay, before we do that, okay. First of all, I want to remind everybody, if you tune in, with me is Linda McKinley, who's one of the founders and developers of the Louisiana Civil Rights Trail. Also Norman Robinson, a TV anchorman with Norman for years, who also worked on the project. But there was a dedication, I think it was the first marker.
It was.
Dougie Chase has always been a beloved place. Okay, Ray Charles did a song called the Early in the Morning, okay? And this is one of his early songs. And he's talking about, he's this guy, and it's early in the morning, and there's things he wants to do, and he wants to go to his girlfriend's house, but his girlfriend's dad chases him away, and everywhere he goes, people say, get away. And anyway, one of the places he says in the songs is that he goes to Dougie Chase, right? So I just want to play this little clip. You got to listen carefully, but Ray Charles talking about Dougie Chase.
I went to Dougie Chase to get something to eat. The waitress looked at me and said, Ray, you sure look me nice early in the morning. I told him it was early in the morning. Yeah, early in the morning. nothing but the blues.
What was the importance of Dookie Chase?
I actually think early Ray Charles must have been leaving my father's house, our house, and then going to Dookie Chase when he made that song. Actually, it's so funny because I love hearing that. We were little girls, and I remember Ray Charles used to come to our house, and you know, and
really?
Mother, oh yeah, it was really interesting. And I remember this interesting story where my mother was trying to prepare us. We were little girls, and she was saying, "Okay, I just want you to be aware that this gentleman is blind, which means he can't see." Well, I was about 5 or 6, and I'm thinking, blind meant you had no eyes. And I remember at the dinner party, I was like, "Mom, he can see, he has eyes." So, you know, it was really cool to grow up with those type of entertainers around the dinner table, and Nancy Wilson and Cannonball Adderley. But, you know, I had a chance.
Okay. So at your house, Nancy Wilson would come by?
Oh, yes. Cannonball Adderley. Just any of the acts that my dad was promoting at the time. I just remember them all just, you know, sitting at the dining room table. You know, it was like, you know, you fixed it in, and the little pretty girls are sitting there and my mom serving. And it was just the way we grew up. So.
What was Ray Charles like?
Well, you know, I probably got removed from the dinner table after that comment, and so I was fairly young. I didn't know what they were talking about. I wasn't impressed. I was just looking for the man with no eyes. But you know, throughout our lives, you know, my dad, throughout the years as we got older, it became more, you know, James Brown, Ray Charles, Michael Jackson, Chaka Khan, you name it. I mean, there were just a lot of people Tina Turner, that would come through. But I just loved hearing him talk to them and talk about them. You know, my father was in radio when radio personalities, DJs, were really making it happen. They were making the music happen. They were making careers happen. And there was a lot of power. It's not the way it is right now. So they were hit makers, and they had a lot of power in the industry. And so, you know, as a result.
Okay, well, we'll get back to Dookie Chase in a second. We may as well talk about this. Your father was a co-owner of Minute Records. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And one of the songs that came out of Minute Records, there's one song out of this whole New Orleans rhythm and blues scene that rose to number one in the nation. And here it is.
Mother-in-law.
Mother-in-law. She worries me so.
Mother-in-law,
mother-in-law, if she leave us alone, oh, we would have a happy home. Sent from down below.
Mother-in-law,
mother-in-law.
And of course, that was Ernie Cato, who I presume came to your house also.
Oh, absolutely. My father gave Ernie Cato the nickname, Ernie Cato.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. I was, you know, these are stories I didn't even know about. I was talking to Ben Sandville. I don't know if you know Ben.
Oh, yeah.
And Ben knows more about my father and my life and early life than I do. And he, you know, and there's a book that he wrote, and that story is in there. So he spent a lot of time interviewing my father when he was writing his book on Ernie Cato. So, yeah. Interesting life.
I think his real name was Kador, K-D-O-R, so maybe your dad. I don't know if we said it or not, but your dad's name was Larry McKinley.
Yes.
Who was well-known, who was probably best known as being a disc jockey, I think, on WYLD, but really active in music scenes. But to have been
I mean, another, you know, Minute Records, I think they were just doing their thing in a time when, you know, people were not, you know, were surprised at the music that was coming out of New Orleans. You know, the other classics include like Jesse Hill's Ooh Poo Poo Doo, Irma Thomas's It's Raining, you know, Benny Spellman's Fortune Teller. So lots and lots of songs with Aaron Neville. It's a very interesting
And by the way, your mother-in-law
that I'm trying to work on putting together right now so that, you know, I can better understand the stories and share it with others.
And mother-in-law, of course, the voice in the background going, mother-in-law, that deep voice is Benny Spellman. Within that. So anyway, so that said, what was the importance of Dookie Chase?
You know, I had an opportunity to interview Sybil Morial, who really, she was very good friends with Leah Chase. And we sat down and she really broke it down for me. And it was significant because it took a lot of courage for Leah Chase to allow people who were meeting, people were coming from all over the country and they were trying to organize and make their plans happen. And they were white and black and they would meet at AP Turo's office and they would sit there and talk and it would be time for them to eat, right? And they couldn't eat together. At that time, blacks and whites could not eat together. And I remember her saying to me that, you know, Leah was like, come on, come on. I had this room over here and it was at the top of the restaurant. You guys come over here and I will get you some good Creole food. Or I'll make you a good bowl of gumbo. And she allowed those meetings to continue. And so it became a very, very significant place for community organizing and basically breaking the law at that time because she allowed whites and blacks who were working together to continue to work together and eat in a very decent way, in a proud way.
So it really became a lot of the epicenter for planning a lot of these things, a lot of the strategies. And I know a lot of the legal advice came from white activists who were involved with it. So the problem was how to get them in and serve them also.
Right, exactly. And I don't know, it's probably one of the epicenters. I think in New Orleans, there were probably many places or where people were doing this. I don't know how many, but it's certainly more than one, but it was a very significant place.
And it was a secret place too.
Yes.
And I can remember they refer to that room. It's actually above the bar at Dookie's, and they referred to it as the upper room because there were a lot of significant events planned there. In fact, one story that Edgar's father, Dookie himself, the old man, told me about was that Walter Cronkite used to come in there. He would come in there and have dinner and with them and get some background information on what was going on in the civil rights movement. So any of the integrated groups that came through there that wanted to strategize about civil rights and how to move forward and what kind of plans that they were going to make, they met there. So it was like the Underground Railroad for the civil rights movement, where blacks and whites would meet together to talk about strategy.
There's a quote on the website. There's a quote on the website, again, I'm paraphrasing, but it's by Leah Chase saying something about that time and saying, I'd like to think that all these problems could have been solved over a good bowl of gumbo.
Yeah.
That gumbo was a key instrument in all of this.
Yeah, she was a strong voice. I mean, she was a universalist in the way she dealt with people. And she, you would think she had a PhD like you, Errol. You would think that you'd think that she had a PhD in humanities because the way she could coalesce with people, the way she could pull people together, and the atmosphere in her restaurant was one of conviviality. You know, you walk in that place and there's a spirit of humane quietness there that lends itself to people kind of coming together in a spiritual way and getting along for the sake of building a better world. That's what she was all about in her way as not only the Creole queen of cuisine. She was a people person, and she had this knack for bringing people together.
Amazingly, her husband was Dookie Chase. You never heard much about him. He got the credit for the restaurant name, and she did all the work.
But you know, when we talk about New Orleans and we talk about the legacy of music, you know, he was a band leader. He was a trumpet player. He was a great, great trumpet player. He was a fantastic band leader. And he sort of gave all that up so that he could raise a family, you know, and they decided to raise their family around that restaurant. It was something that he and his wife built together, and he was very comfortable with letting her be out front, because she was that kind of charismatic person in his life, and he didn't mind that at all. He supported her 100%, but he gave up his big career as a band leader and a musician so that he could support his family, and so that he could be there, and he could be a foundation for them all. He was the rock in that. He was the rock in that relationship. He kept them together.
He was. And I think I was talking to a family member recently, and I think they're in the process of refurbishing the upper room. So I'm sure there'll be more to come on.
I'm thinking the location of Dookie Chase on Orleans, not far from Claiborne. That's like on the edge of, or maybe it technically is, in Treme.
Yeah.
And that whole area is such a culturally significant area. And it's an important place. And now I'm glad they've revived it and bringing it back, and did a great job.
Yeah.
They had an event when they dedicated the plaque or the sign there. And Norman, I remember seeing you there. I hadn't seen you there. And it was wonderful. And they fixed a meal for, must have been 150 people. And,
no, it was huge, right? It was so exciting.
Yeah, they're very generous. By the way, the symbol of the trails, I don't know if it's just for this one trail or for the entire movie, but to me, it's wonderful. It's an illustration of Ruby Bridges. And then behind her is this big kind of like hunky white man who's like obviously some kind of security guy. And he's walking around. And he has, it's very touching. He has his hand on her shoulder as though he's kind of guiding her. And you can tell she's a little bit apprehensive. But the emotional impact of that symbol, it's very, very nice.
Yes. I mean, it's so interesting. If you go to Mississippi, and you'll see that. And, you know, one of the things that we want to do is we have to own the things that belong to us, right? And so we're very thrilled that Mississippi and Alabama and all these other places like to tell our story. But the lieutenant governor really felt like it was our responsibility to go in deep and tell the full story. And I mean, the Louisiana Civil Rights Trail is a work in progress. It's ever evolving. And, you know, we just keep updating it as more stories and more information becomes available and known to us.
Do we know what the next site's going to be?
Nope, don't know yet. But, you know, right now, the interesting thing about the sites, there's a lot of coordination that goes into where we place the markers once we identify the marker locations. And so it's not like a priority, like, oh, those were the first priority ones, even though those were very iconic things. But those were just easiest for us to work with the building owners. A couple of them, you know, state property. And so that really is what determined what went first and how they're being rolled out.
Again, I urge everybody to go to, what's the best way to get to it? To Louisiana Tourism on the website or? The state.
You can go straight to LouisianaCivilRightsTrail.com.
Okay, and it's a really good website. You know, I was trying to think. We're talking about Ernie Cato. One of his famous quotes, I think it was always in the downbeat that you always see it. Is that I don't know, but I hear all music comes from New Orleans. Remember that?
Yeah.
And of course, it's true. All music did come from New Orleans. Yeah?
Right.
My one lament about Ray Charles, where I think the cosmos made a mistake, is that Ray Charles should have been from New Orleans. Imagine if Ray Charles would have grown up in New Orleans and he would have run the same streets with the Nevilles or with Alan Toussaint, just a Fats Domino.
I mean, that would have been amazing.
Yeah, imagine if they'd all been in the same crowd. I mean,
that would have been crazy.
Yeah, his music would have had a different beat to it. I remember Sherman Bernard, who is an audio specialist, went with one of the popular brass bands to Switzerland, and the bass drummer got sick. And they said, well, you're going to have to fill in for the bass drummer, Sherman. And he says, but I don't know anything about drumming. He says, well, all you got to do is when you beat that beat on the bass drum, if there's a particular beat that the bass drummer has to carry in order to have authentic New Orleans music. And it says, what you do is you go, that night war, that night war, that night war, that night war. Just keep that beat up on the bass drum and you got it. That's the New Orleans flavor, baby. That's fun.
Linda, in closing, I just want to ask you, your dad must have been proud of the Jazz Fest. And what would he feel emerge from there?
Yeah, I mean, he loved the Jazz Fest. It was his favorite time of year. I talked to Quint and I talked to a lot of people, and I'm really trying to thoroughly understand the role, because I mean, if you talk to Quint, you hear about the evolution of Jazz Fest and how it came about. And Quint was very inspired by the concerts and the shows that my father had been producing. As a founding member, I think he was on the board, and I think eventually he got off of the board because, you know, he wanted to be a part of the production and make money as part of the Jazz Festival. So yeah, he was very proud. He could not believe, I mean, he just remembers the very early days of Jazz Fest, and when you would look out at the massive crowds and what it had become, it's just kind of hard to imagine that from its humble beginnings. And I mean, it happened over a period of time, but you know, well, it's just amazing. I mean, it's just beyond anyone's expectations. I'm sure anyone who thought of it, George Ween and Quentin Davis and those who were there from the beginning.
I think the Jazz Fest saved gospel music in New Orleans, at least New Orleans style. I mean, it really put it on the map. It really gave it like a public forum where people could see. I mean, there would have been gospel music anyway, but not a lot of access out there. And I think it also did the same thing like with Cajun and Zydeco. That put that music on the stage that people wouldn't have seen it. And probably to a certain extent the Mardi Gras Indians, because back then the Indians only went out a few blocks on Mardi Gras. And then all of a sudden they have that kind of access to it. And so they may have been, your dad and the other founders may have been interested in one form of music. And I think it had a big impact on other forms of music. So anyway, thank you all very much. It's been very, very educational. I just want to ask you one question on the way out. Your favorite rhythm and blues song, give me two.
Oh my God. Norman Newman,
you can say mother-in-law. Okay, Norman.
Yeah, that would be, what's the one by Frogman Henry? I Ain't Got No Home.
Okay, yeah.
I Ain't Got No Home. And then there's one rhythm and blues song. It's kind of archaic, but I like it. And Sharon Martin sings it all the time. And it's like, she sings it and she does a great job with it. Called It's a Great Day to Whoop Somebody's Ass.
I think I'm going to have to pass on the question because I just have, I can't pick a favorite. It would be impossible for me to do that.
Ernie Cato had another song, Taint It the Truth. And it's all, I think that's a wonderful, wonderful song with the chorus behind it and all that. Anyway.
Irma Thomas. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's raining.
Anyway, thank you all. This is, thank you for your work. And we're looking forward to see what's ahead. Actually, we're looking forward to what exists right now. Again, I urge everybody to go to that website and just look at it. It's really good. So the closing for us tonight is Mr. Ernie Cato.
Mother-in-law, Satan shouldn't be her name.
Mother-in-law,
to me they're about the same.
Thanks for listening to Louisiana Insider. Subscribe, like, and rate our show where you listen to your podcasts, and follow us on social media at Louisiana Life Mag. Executive producer for Louisiana Insider is Kelly Massico, in cooperation with Louisiana Life Magazine. For subscription information to Louisiana Life, call 504-828-1380. Our theme music was provided by Rich Collins. Hey, that's me. Join us again next week for more discoveries inside Louisiana.